Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Lost Origins, your number one radio show for all things ancient mystery, alternative historical theory, and lost civilizations. I'm your host, Andrew, and I want every single one of you to hop online, head over to lost-origins.com, and sign up for that free newsletter. We are in the process of rolling out several contests. We've got some awesome merchandise that we're going to be giving away, but the only way that you can win it or be a part of the contest is if you've subscribed to that newsletter. So pop your email in there. You'll never miss an article or an episode from your friends here at Lost Origins. You guys can also connect with us on social media. We are super active on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. So hit that subscribe button and stay in the know with all things ancient mystery. This week's episode of Lost Origins is brought to you by Contact in the Desert. If you're a fan of ancient mystery, ancient astronaut theory, alternative historical theory, etc., you guys do not want to miss this event. This is like the mecca for ancient mystery and ancient astronaut theory. From June 3rd to June 6th in Joshua Tree, California, some of the greatest minds within this field will be gathering for one of the most incredible conference lineups I've ever seen. So many speakers that you guys are familiar with are going to be taking the stage, including Graham Hancock, David Childress, Robert Bouval, Giorgio Tsoukalos, Jason Martell, Linda Moulton Howell, David Wilcock, Carl Lerberger, Eric Van Daniken. I mean, the list goes on and on. So make sure that if you can attend, that you do. This is an experience you don't want to miss. You can head over to contactinthedesert.com and snag up your tickets while they're still left. This week's episode of Lost Origins is also brought to you by Inner Traditions and Baron Company. Our friends over at Inner Traditions have been publishing books on esoteric philosophy, New Age spirituality, alternative health, and ancient mystery for well over 40 years. So check out their website at innertraditions.com. You guys can sign up for coupons and special offers. You can learn about books and their authors. These guys know what they're doing. I mean, the catalog that they have at Inner Traditions is phenomenal. We read tons of books on ancient mystery and esoteric knowledge over here at Lost Origins, and everything that we've ever read that has come out of Inner Traditions or Baron Company, we highly recommend. Fantastic stuff from those guys. So check them out online. You will not be disappointed. You know, since I was a kid, I've always been just such a huge fan of the medieval stories of King Arthur, the Knights of the Round Table, and Camelot. I can remember being really young and my parents reading me these stories. And then as I started to grow older, I always kind of returned to these stories and wondered if there was any historical truth behind these tales, right? So today we're going to uncover the truth, if you will, behind these stories as we have the chance of chatting with world-famous author Graham Phillips. Graham has been described as a historical detective, a modern-day adventurer, but my favorite, a real-life Indiana Jones. And he is the author of The End of Eden, The Templars and the Ark of the Covenant, Atlantis and the Ten Plagues of Egypt, The Chalice of Magdalene, The Moses Legacy, and most recently, The Lost Tomb of King Arthur. So today we'll be discussing his research surrounding the famous monarch, who King Arthur really was, and where his tomb lies, right after the break. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to this week's episode of Lost Origins. If you're just tuning in, I'm your host, Andrew, and this week we are joined by the real-life Indiana Jones, Graham Phillips. Graham is the author of The End of Eden, The Templars and the Ark of the Covenant, Atlantis and the Ten Plagues of Egypt, The Chalice of Magdalene, The Moses Legacy, and most recently, The Lost Tomb of King Arthur. I am so excited to discuss the truth behind King Arthur, and it is my pleasure to welcome from England, Graham Phillips. Graham, thank you for joining us on Lost Origins today.
Well, thank you, Andrew, for having me on.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. You know, I've always been such a huge fan of these stories that my parents read me growing up, the medieval account of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table and Camelot. And, you know, I've always been just drawn back to these stories time and time again. So I'm very excited for our conversation today. I'm really looking forward to picking your brain about your research surrounding King Arthur. So today should be fun.
Please ask anything you like.
That's a loaded question on this show, so you got to be careful. Before we dig into your work, Graham, I always like to get a bit of background from our guests who haven't been on the show before. So for our listeners who maybe aren't familiar with your work, can you give us a bit of your background? What drew you into researching ancient mysteries to the point where you would author several books on the topic?
Well, it all started back in approximately 1980, when I was a magazine editor. I was trained in journalism, and rather than just going to ordinary news reporting, I ended up editing a magazine that was devoted to the odd and the unusual. That, by that I mean unexplained mysteries. And that was in England, and going back to 1980, it was one of the first magazines to actually do that.
Sure.
And so I kind of got into investigating unexplained things, everything from Bigfoot to UFOs to unsolved historical mysteries. And then when I actually left the magazine, I thought, you know, I'm really become fascinated, not so much by the paranormal, but by mysteries that perhaps I've got a way of explaining. I mean, the problem about the paranormal I always found is that you always ended up never really finding out the answer,
sure,
just finding out some more weird stuff. So historical mysteries, now there was something I kind of could get my teeth into. So I first investigated a lost jewel that was said to have belonged to the British Mary Queen of Scots back in Shakespeare's time. Mm-hmm. And when she was executed, it was said that a ring that she possessed that was of great value was hidden and no one had ever found it. And there were various clues as to where it was. So I went in search of this, ended up following a trail of historical clues that had been led by people, left by people, you know, 400 years ago. And ultimately, cutting a very long story short, discovered this ring hidden in a brass casket.
Really?
Buried in the ground. And from then I was hooked. And I managed to get a book published about this, and I didn't do too badly with the book, and it financed me to carry on doing what I was doing. And I suddenly found myself in a kind of fairly unique position, certainly in England, of being able to investigate unsolved historical mysteries, search for lost tombs, search for lost artifacts, and historical mysteries that had never been explained to be looked into at least, and write books and get paid for doing it. And that's what I did. And after that, I did a book you've mentioned some of the books I've done. I've looked into the mystery of the Ark of the Covenant, mm-hmm. The Holy Grail, the search for the tomb of Alexander the Great. And over the years, I think I've written about 13 books that have been published, and that's just what I've been doing for most of my life.
Wow.
Well, since I've been an adult anyway. And that's where we come to today, with me having done this whole thing into the search for the lost tomb of King Arthur.
Very cool. I mean, it's living the dream, right? I mean, so many people, I think, are drawn into these ancient mysteries, and I think so many people have aspirations to try to solve them. Because you're right, I mean, the paranormal is fascinating. It's very interesting. You know, a lot of our listeners, myself included, are fans of the show Ancient Aliens. And, you know, that's very intriguing concepts and theories, but you're right, ancient mysteries are something that's a challenge or a question that can be solved or answered. So that makes total sense.
I mean, it's like, if you're not, like, for example, I mean, we know Alexander the Great was a real figure. His tomb is somewhere. It's just that no one had found it.
Right.
So as I was charging all over the place, looking for this tomb and trying to put together the whole mystery of his life and where he himself may have decided he wanted to be buried, I knew that even if I didn't manage to succeed, it was there somewhere.
Right.
Whereas if you're trying to solve something to do with the ghost that is said to have been seen in a certain house, at the end of the day, you don't know for certain that you're ever really going to see that ghost.
Right, right. Yeah, that, well said. I mean, there's so many stories and myths throughout the historical account or narrative of our species that forever scholars and historians just attribute those to being just that, myths or stories. The city of Troy is a perfect example, right? And until that was actually found and proven to not be myth, you know, it was discredited. And so I think it's going to be really interesting to talk about King Arthur because, you know, many people consider him just a legend. But based on your research, we have evidence that argues the opposite, right? So, like I said at the beginning of our conversation, I grew up having my parents read me these stories. I was always intrigued by King Arthur, Knights of the Round Table, and Camelot. And so I would like to get from your perspective, based on your research, who was King Arthur?
Okay, it's probably a good idea if I just clarify the legend that you were talking about,
sure,
if your parents would have told you, because not maybe everybody isn't completely aware of the entirety of the legend of Arthur, explained in about half a paragraph. Basically, the story of King Arthur is that he's a young man, he pulls a sword from a stone that no one else can pull from this stone. This makes him king. Everybody accepts that he is the king because the prophecy is only he who can pull a sword from this sword from a stone is the king of Britain. Arthur does this, he becomes the king of the Britons. He founds this order of knights called the Knights of the Round Table, and they establish a magnificent castle and stronghold at a city called Camelot, somewhere in Britain. Over the period of time, the kingdom falls into civil war. Arthur becomes ill, and in order to cure Arthur and make the whole of Britain prosperous again, the knights have to go in search of this ancient chalice called the Holy Grail that, if drunk from, can cure any ills. And when they find it, Arthur drinks from this chalice and he is cured, and so is the land. Everything goes great until eventually one day Arthur's nephew, his treacherous nephew Mordred, rebels against him, and in a final battle Arthur and Mordred kill each other, and as Arthur lies dying on the field of battle, he tells his knight Bedivere to take his sword Excalibur and throw it into a nearby lake. And when the knight does this, the arm of this mysterious nymph-like creature called the Lady of the Lake rises from the surface, grabs the weapon by the hilt, and takes it down into the watery depths. And then, when the knight returns to where he was leaving Arthur dying, he finds that Arthur is being sailed across this lake on a barge bound for a mysterious island that lies in the middle of the lake called Avalon, where he is ultimately buried. Mm-hmm. Now that, in a nutshell, is the story of King Arthur. And where this came from, we're saying, well, you know, where does this story, who wrote it? Well, it wasn't written by one person. From around about the year 1135, various people in Europe, particularly in Britain, started to write stories about King Arthur, one after another, adding a little bit more to the saga. More themes were added until eventually, by the 1400s, you've got the story pretty much as I mentioned it to you just now. And that is the, if you like, the legendary King Arthur.
Sure. And so now, based on your research, who was the real King Arthur?
I think probably first it might be a good idea to explain why I even thought there might have been a real King Arthur.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because all the things I've just told you about him sound pretty unbelievable. I mean, and that's just some of it. I mean, he fights dragons, he rescues damsels in distress, there's wizards and witches.
Merlin, right, yeah.
You've got Merlin, the wizard, and all of this. And, of course, it all sounds pretty far-fetched, so why would you even think that anything about it was true? Well, the reason is that, as I say, the first of these stories of Arthur, which were written during what's known as the Middle Ages, the first of these stories was written at around about 1135. But 300 years before that, in the 830s, there was a British monk by the name of Nennius who wrote a history of Britain called the Historia Britonum, which means the history of the Britons in Latin.
Right.
In which he talks about this King Arthur, but he doesn't involve him in any forms of magic or mystery. There's no flights of fancy. He writes about Arthur in a purely historical sense as a real down-to-earth warrior. And he tells us that the man called Arthur was a warrior who united as a high king all of Britain around the year 500 in an attempt to push out a series of invaders. Now, he also tells us, and we know this certainly from other historical accounts and from archaeology, in the 400s, the Roman Empire collapsed, and the Romans had been ruling Britain for centuries. Mm-hmm. Once the Roman Empire collapsed, the whole of Britain fell apart into separate kingdoms, and there was feuding and anarchy. And into this divided country came these invaders from Germany, known as the Anglo-Saxons, who eventually conquered all of Britain. But for a while, Nennius tells us, around 500 AD, they were stopped in their tracks by a powerful warrior called Arthur, who united all these warring tribes of Britons to fight back and successfully halt the Anglo-Saxon and push them almost back into the sea for around 30 years until he died. He tells us about some of the battles Arthur fought. He tells us a little bit about who he was, but he doesn't mention anything about all the later stories that we've come to associate with Arthur. Sure. And consider him to be fanciful. Mm-hmm. So that's why I thought there was a real Arthur.
It's fascinating, though. I mean, it's always interesting, too, to see how a historical figure like Arthur or, Genghis Khan, for example, there's the historical account, and then their stories are built on with myth and legend that just creates this huge, larger-than-life persona. So after you have, discovered and decided that there's something here worth investigating, your research into King Arthur found what? What did you find out about the real King Arthur?
Well, the biggest problem I had in investigating the period in which Arthur is said to have lived is that virtually no written records have survived.
Sure.
Now, many historians you could have on your show, and they would say to you, no, Arthur didn't exist. There's absolute rubbish. I won't even talk about it. For two reasons. The first reason is they might just be thinking about the medieval romanticized King Arthur who mm-hmm. fights dragons and so forth. Well, clearly he, in that context, didn't exist.
Right.
And they won't take it any further. You would then get other historians who would say, well, yes, there may have been a monk called Nennius who wrote about him 300 years earlier than these romances, but he's writing about a character that is said to have lived 300 years before his time. Mm-hmm. And we know there's very few records of that time have survived, because in the turbulence that had beset Britain after the Romans left, very few people were writing anything. They were pretty much just trying to survive by fighting each other.
Right.
And when you've got no records, you've got no name, and they'll say, of the few records that do survive, of the few inscriptions that have survived on buildings or in old stones, there is not one mention anywhere ever being found of the name Arthur at the time he's said to have lived. Mm-hmm. So they'll say there's no evidence for him. Nennius may have heard legends about this guy and thought, well, let's say what we can about him. Let's try and make him a little bit more historical.
Right.
And that's what a lot of... So the first problem I really had was to look at a period where others had looked before and found no name or no mention of anyone who could have been King Arthur. And where was I going to find such such documentation if nobody else had ever found it?
Right. Well, so where did you end up looking then?
Well, I decided to start from and this is part, many people have said to me, how come you have managed to find Arthur get on the trail of him when other people haven't?
Right.
Is it because you're in tune with some kind of mystical presence? Well, no, I'd like to say that I was. I've been very lucky to have been researching at a period when there's been massive advances made in archaeology. Now, history is the study of ancient books and inscriptions and so forth,
right.
Whereas archaeology is the study of things that are dug up out of the ground to tell us what was going on in Britain or whatever country in the world you're doing the archaeology in at a particular time. Now, the archaeology had actually shown us far more about what was going on in Britain about 500 AD than had ever been known before, mm-hmm. in the 90s and in the early 2000s when I began doing this research, mm-hmm. and I thought, if there is not any surviving written evidence for Arthur, maybe there's some archaeological evidence for him instead. So the question was, have archaeologists found a place that could have been Arthur's capital? So I began by searching. According to the legend, Arthur establishes this incredible city called Camelot, mm-hmm. which is the capital of Britain, the most impressive city in Britain. Well, it was no good looking for somewhere actually called Camelot, because this was an actual invention of a 12th century French poet, the name. Mm-hmm. But before his time, there were earlier stories, fragments of stories, to say that this man Arthur had ruled from the most impressive city in Britain, the capital of Britain in 500 AD. Had archaeology got to the point of telling us what this capital actually was? We know it can't have been London, because London had been invaded by the Anglo-Saxons.
Right.
So they had to have another capital. And it turned out that archaeology had found out that what then became, after London, the capital of Britain, was a place called Viriconium, which is pretty much smack bang in the middle of England in a county called Shropshire. And the archaeological work that's been done there has shown that it was an important city in Roman times, but around the year 500 AD became the capital of Dark Age Britain, the period of Britain when Arthur is said to have lived. Mm-hmm. So I decided that was the best place to begin my search.
Right. You know, and before we dig into that, because I do want to talk about Camelot, I'd like to get your take on why Arthur, right? Like, why did his story survive when, you know, there were so many other monarchs of his time, so many other warriors of his time? Like, many of those have long since been forgotten. We have no idea, especially from this era, that there's not much documentation that has survived. So why has Arthur survived the centuries like this?
It's because during the Middle Ages, I'll use the word Dark Ages of Middle Ages.
Sure.
What I'm referring to by the Dark Ages is the period from when Arthur is said to have, after the Romans left in the late 400s, after the Roman Empire collapsed in the late 400s, mm-hmm. until about the year 1000. That's the Dark Ages, a period of warfare, Anglo-Saxons fighting native Britons, Vikings and all that. Mm-hmm. Then you've got a period called the Medieval period, where things become much more stable. And that goes on from around about 1000 AD to, say, 1500 AD. Mm-hmm. And during that period, the people who ruled Britain during the Middle Ages were the French. They invaded Britain in 1066. And as they were ruling Britain, they were known as the Normans, because they came from Normandy, northern mm-hmm. France. Mm-hmm. And they ruled Britain. But they, in the eyes of the church, in the eyes of the Pope, didn't actually really have any legitimate right to be ruling the place. By this time, the Anglo-Saxons had long been the kings of Britain or England. So consequently, there were many Saxon lords who were saying, hold on, Mr. Pope, if they went to Rome to see him,
sure.
I should be king. Can't you make me king of England? And it was very important. to have the support of the Roman Catholic Church, because without it, the people wouldn't tend to support you, because everyone was extraordinarily religious in those days, mm-hmm. and there was only one form of Christianity in that part of Europe, and that was Catholicism.
Right.
So the Pope's opinion was very important. So what these new French people that invaded Britain and were ruling it, the French kings of Britain, desperately wanted to have a case to present to the Pope and to the Vatican that they had the right to rule Britain. Well, it was no good saying that they were descended from an Anglo-Saxon king, because they were the ones they'd taken over from. Mm-hmm. But they did have a legitimate case that they were descended from the Britons who had ruled in this country before the Saxons arrived. Because when the Saxons eventually did push the Britons out during the period after Arthur's death, and partly into the Welsh mountains in the western part of Britain, but many of them fled across the English Channel into France. Mm-hmm. And it was their descendants who, some of them at least, were the Normans, the people who conquered Britain. So they would say that, well, we're actually descended from the people who used to rule the place before the Anglo-Saxons turned up. Hmm. Good case. They needed somebody, though, that appeared to be a genuine king. But the problem with most of the post-Roman warriors who ruled Britain before the Saxons turned up is that were mainly chieftains or tribal leaders.
Sure.
But the one character that seems to have had far more clout and basically taken over the lot of these tribes for a short period around 500 AD was this renowned warrior, Arthur. Mm. And the first of these Arthurian romances, as they were called, that were written during the Middle Ages, that was composed in 1135, was written by a guy who was specifically sponsored, patronized by the king to write about him. In other words, he said, find out everything you can about this Arthur. He sounds like a king. Make him as great as you like. Make him as fanciful as you like.
Sure.
But put everything together you can about this guy. And when I next see the Pope, I can tell him about this guy and say I'm descended from him. And Arthur was that guy. And Arthur, therefore, became a crucial figure mm-hmm. in a medieval propaganda exercise. And therefore, over the next few centuries, what started off as a political ruse ended up as a very popular subject of romantic fiction.
Sure, sure. They started out trying to sell the hell out of him, and then now we still hear about him. It's great.
He reached a critical mass.
Right. Very good.
He exploded.
Right. Well, thank you for explaining that. I always find it interesting, especially from the researchers who are spending time within these specific topics, their take on why that myth continued to pick up steam and pick up bits along the way. So thank you very much. I want to return to Camelot, Graham. I know that we kind of deviated from the topic there, but I do want to talk about Camelot, your time researching that specific site. We do have to take a quick break, so when we come back, let's dig in to all things Camelot. We'll be right back with more from Graham Phillips. All right, ladies and gentlemen, and we are back. I'm your host, Andrew, and if you're just tuning in, this week we are talking to author, researcher, and the real-life Indiana Jones, Graham Phillips. Graham's latest book, The Lost Tomb of King Arthur, explores all things from the Arthurian legend himself, and also discusses Camelot and the Lost Tomb of King Arthur. So before the break, we were talking about the mythological history of King Arthur, and then the likely true history of King Arthur. And then we started discussing Camelot briefly. And Graham, I want to come back to that. So you had mentioned Camelot having been kind of in the middle of England, and that site has now been excavated, correct?
Yeah, it's amazing because the walls, the ruined walls and foundations of this 1,500-year-old city still survive today. Hmm. I mean, you can go out and you can look at them. The actual site is open to the public.
Wow.
And there's a small museum there which displays many of the items and artifacts that have been found during excavations. Now, what's amazing about it is it originally was a Roman city, like London had been. But whereas London, if you want to find out something about Roman London, you've got to dig under the streets, you've got to dig under extruded office blocks, and you've got to...
Right.
You're not going to find much.
Right.
But the amazing thing about Viriconium, which became the capital after London was conquered by the Anglo-Saxons, is that it, no other city, once it was eventually abandoned a few hundred years later, and no new city was built on top of it. So its ruins just remain there in open countryside, wow, which has meant that archaeologists have been able to do excavations there that they've not been able to do in any other Roman city in Britain.
Right, right.
And from these excavations, they were able to find out that something quite astonishing, rather than the city gradually being abandoned, as happened with many other Roman cities after the end of the Roman Empire, Viriconium was continued to be occupied for decades. And around 500, it was actually rebuilt, refortified in an astonishing way.
Hmm.
It is considered, in fact, to have been, from what archaeologists have determined, the most impressive city, the largest and the most magnificent city in Britain around the year 500.
Oh,
in
wow.
other words, its capital.
Wow.
And what is even more incredible, they were able to excavate and discover that right in the middle of this city, around 500, there was erected a large winged mansion, which appears to have been the palatial palace, Roman-style palatial palace, of a very important post-Roman warlord.
Mm.
And they go so far as to say that we know that somebody must have united the Britons in their fight against the Anglo-Saxons for a few years around that period. Whether they believe it's Arthur or not is neither here nor there. Somebody must have done it. And they think that this palatial construction in the middle of Viriconium was the seat of that important warlord.
Mm, wow.
So, what I was concluding myself was this. Around, according to the stories, and according to this monk Nennius, who wrote in a very sensible way about Arthur lived around about the year 500 AD. He ruled Britain from the most impressive city in the country. The most impressive city in the country around the year 500 AD was Viriconium.
Right.
And someone built a palace there at exactly that time. It was pretty obvious to me that whoever was behind the Arthur legend had to have been whoever lived there. And that's what I had to find out next.
Right. So what is modern, academia's take on this? I mean, any time somebody is researching myth, you know, that's kind of like the redheaded stepchild of research, you know? I mean, a lot of scholars and archaeologists won't even touch it, right? I mean, it's like a career kryptonite.
Well, they don't mention Arthur at all. When, if you read anything, I mean, there's plenty about Viriconium online. There's plenty of books about
sure.
it. And you'll see people saying exactly what I've said. In other words, that Viriconium seems to become possibly the capital of Britain, if you like.
Sure.
After the fall of the Roman Empire, it was certainly a very important city, the most important in central Britain. There was this palace of a very important person, a warlord. But we don't know who it was. It could be anyone.
Right.
That is pretty much the stand that the archaeologists will go by,
right,
and they'll say that. Well, they won't even mention Arthur. When I've spoken to archaeologists and historians in private, they're prepared to say, "Yeah, we like your theory, but you do realise it's pretty much academic suicide to actually mention his name."
Right.
So that's as far as they go.
Right. Interesting. So, what's your take on Excalibur then? I mean, with the evidence surrounding Viriconium having been Camelot, I mean, that seems to be overwhelming. Do you think Excalibur was then a topic that was picked up along the way as the myth was kind of steamrolling through the ages? Or do you think that Excalibur maybe did have some mythological qualities to it?
You know, when I was looking into the story of Arthur, and I realized I've got to separate the myth from the possible truth here, one of the top of the list themes in the Arthurian story, which I considered to be most likely totally made up, was the Excalibur theme. This mm-hmm. whole idea that the Lady of the Lake, I mean, this kind of mermaid type person who lives in a lake, who grabs hold of a sword, and, you know, that bit, I thought, yeah, that can't be true.
Right.
But strangely enough, this appears to be one of the themes that is the most likely. In other words, it's something that may have been associated with the historical King Arthur, and then later this became romanticized a bit.
Hmm.
Because Roman writers and that lived during the late Roman Empire talk about the Celtic people, the native Britons, as having this tradition that when a leader or an important king died, his sword would be thrown into a sacred lake or pool mm. as an offering to a water goddess.
Interesting.
So if you imagine that maybe as Arthur is dying or his funeral takes place, his sword is thrown into a sacred lake in the belief that it is being given to a water goddess in the hope that she either cures him or grants him safe passage to the underworld, mm-hmm. this could, over the centuries, have turned into the story of the Lady of the Lake.
There you go.
A physical person who actually lives in the lake. But what's most incredible and makes me certain that this is a true, that I'm right about this, is that the Lady of the Lake is called Vivien. That's her name in the early Arthurian stories. The goddess that they threw these swords to, according to the Romans, was called Viviana. Viviana, Vivien, mm-hmm. surely mm-hmm. one's based on the other.
Right.
But we know it's not just the Romans telling us this and getting our facts mixed up. Archaeologists have excavated the dried up beds of ancient sacred lakes and have found that many items were thrown as offerings into these lakes to various deities. They're known as votive offerings. And these items very often included swords. So we know it really did happen. We know that the Lady of the Lake has almost the same name as the lake goddess that which during funerals a person's sword was thrown to. I think that really did happen in some way. In other words, Arthur's funeral is being recorded and later gradually turned into a medieval fairy tale.
Wow. That's incredible. It's so great to see, you know, the archaeological evidence of these lake beds being excavated that just reinforce that. That's interesting. I would have never thought that piece, because I would agree with you going into this, you think that the Excalibur story, you know, the sword from the stone, Lady in the Lake, that has to be the biggest myth built into this story, right?
Absolutely.
But it's just fascinating to see you say almost the opposite, you know? So the million-dollar question then, Graham, is what is the average airspeed velocity of an unladen swallow?
Yellow.
Just a little Monty Python humor for you real quick. Seriously, though, your research has taken you on an incredible journey to locate this lost tomb of King Arthur. And based on your research, you found it, right? I mean, tell us about this tomb. Where is it? Has it been excavated? Is the location accepted by scholars as having been the resting place of King Arthur, or, you know, as we talked about with Camelot, you know, a great medieval warlord? But tell us about the tomb.
Well, it's going back to Camelot, I thought, okay, archaeologists will not say that this is Arthur, but do we know by any inscriptions anywhere who ruled around the year 500? And there survives in the British Library in London a series of manuscripts that were written during the Dark Ages called genealogies, family trees, mm-hmm. which basically tell us the various kings who ruled the various kingdoms of Britain. And from this, we actually do know the name of the person who ruled Viriconium, this capital of Britain, around 500. And I thought, wow. But you should see the look on the archaeologist's face, almost smug, when they told me it wasn't Arthur.
Right.
I said, what was his name? He says, his name was Owen Fanguin. I thought, oh. So for ages, I was very disappointed.
Yeah, that seems very anticlimactic.
Oh, totally.
just some guy named Owen.
Owen Fanguin could become sort of mythologized as a man called Arthur. Somebody changes his name further down the line. That was until I read one of the only surviving works from that period was written by another monk. It was only monks who were doing writing. They were the only ones who knew how to write during the Dark Ages. A monk called Gildas, who wrote within living memory of Arthur's time. He wrote around about the year 454. And what he wrote, no, 545, sorry, I don't want to get anybody telling me I'm getting anything wrong here.
No worries.
He wrote within literally living memory of Arthur's time. And in this, he writes about Owen Fanguin, the man who ruled from Viriconium. But he calls him by his title. Now, at this time, many people, many leaders in Britain, and it was a Celtic tradition for warriors, to have the battle name or title of an animal. To some way express their prowess in fighting. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're cunning, you're the fox or something like this.
Sure.
So you've got the fox, the eagle, the horse, the hound, and so forth. And he refers to Owen Fanguin under the Latin word Ursus. Now, Ursus in English means the bear. So Owen Fanguin was known as the bear. Mm-hmm. And what is incredible is when I translated the word bear back into Brythonic, which was the language spoken in Britain at the time, the word for a bear is Arth, A-R-T-H. Hmm. And if anyone doubts that, what descended from Brythonic is a modern language which is still spoken today, and that's Welsh. And in Welsh dictionary, you look up the word bear and you will see Arth, A-R-T-H. Now, I know that's not exactly Arthur, but the man who ruled from the most powerful city in the country at the very time that Arthur ruled from the most powerful city in the country, according to legend, was actually called Arth.
It seems.
I then looked back at the archaeologist and said, yeah.
Right. So too close to be coincidental.
Is this man whose title, in other words, Arthur, probably has gone down in history under the name, under his title. It's easy to see how Arth could become Arthur, especially when you might have incorporated both the Brythonic Arth and Latin Ursus, Arthursus, which mm-hmm. then becomes shortened to Arthur. But however it happened, it's such a similar name. Now, what I needed to know now was what happened to this guy, Arth, the man who's known as the bear, the man who's gone down in history under his title, which would explain, by the way, one of the mysteries I said at the beginning, or one of the objections that certain academics would have, is no one has ever found any documentation of anybody called Arthur mm-hmm. doing anything. Well, really, the fact is that there is documentation, but he didn't go down under history as his real name, but under his title. I mean, he wouldn't be the first person who'd gone down in history under a title. You mentioned Genghis Khan before.
Right.
That's not his real name. That's his title. It means universal ruler. His real name is Temujin. The man who created the largest empire the world has ever known went down in history under his title,
right.
Universal ruler, Genghis Khan. And it seems like Arthur is another figure, Owen Fanguin, who went down into history under his title, Arthur. But incredibly, the documentation survives as to where he was buried. Now, you have to obviously accept that King Arthur is Owen Fanguin.
Right.
Accept that I know where he's buried. But if you do accept the evidence that King Arthur and Owen Fanguin are one and the same, the documentation that survives in an ancient Dark Age war poem if you want to know where it is, it's in the Oxford University's Bodleian Library. This Dark Age war poem refers to where he is buried. We are told that he is buried at a place called the Churches of Bassa. So I looked on a map around the whole of the area of Viriconium to find out if there's anything like that. And there's only one place that sounds anything like it. A village that's today called Bass Church. Churches of Bassa, Bass Church.
Right.
I mean, surely it's got to be the same place. And just outside this village of Bass Church is a hillock which once stood in the middle of a lake. Parts of that lake have now dried up over the centuries because for reclaiming land for farming purposes, but it was once a hillock in the middle of an island in the middle of a lake. And the limited archaeology that has been done there has shown that it was in use around the year 500 AD as some sort of ceremonial place. In other words, it doesn't seem to have been used for purely defensive purposes. There are certain earthworks there that give that kind of impression. And I suddenly thought, that is the only thing that dates from that period that could be the original Churches of Bassa, because the modern village of Bass Church right next to it is only dates from a later period, but got its name from something that was there earlier. Mm. So I thought, well, this hillock in the middle of this lake must have been where this guy was buried. And then I suddenly thought, wow, Arthur was buried on an island of Avalon in right. the middle of a lake.
Right.
And so I thought, we have got to have some kind of scientific study or some kind of archaeological scan of this area to find out if there's anyone buried there. Mm-hmm. And cutting a long story short, the archaeologists, I was able to organise an archaeological survey, including different types of geophysics equipment, that is ground, such as ground penetrating radar,
sure.
which can show what's underneath the earth without the need to dig. And right where I said, according to this old poem, Owen Thangwyn would be buried, there was a circular ditch about 6 feet wide and 6 feet deep that at some point in the past had been filled in. The machinery can tell that in a computer generated image.
Right.
But first the archaeologist said, well, this is consistent with the kind of grave dug for important individuals around the period you're talking about. And then they said, and we're pretty sure it is a grave because right in the middle of this circular pit, there is a large piece of iron, which we think is a shield. Mm. And we know that from various records and other finds, that warriors of the period were buried in circular pits on their side with a shield on their arm. Mm-hmm. So right where Owen is supposed to be buried, somebody buried almost certainly of the right time in the right custom is buried. And if Owen is Arthur, that's his tomb.
Wow. And it's crazy too, because there's so many similarities. I mean, even if you don't accept that Owen is Arthur, right? Let's just play that side of it real quick. There's right. still too many similarities or common denominators here between Arthur and the Church of Bass. I mean, it's just insane that there are this many commonalities. Like that becomes, I think, much more difficult to discredit as coincidental, you know? It's truly fascinating.
I think some of the archaeologists involved, I mean, those involved in the geophysics survey, county archaeologists, I think begrudgingly, accept that I've got something going with my theory. They certainly want to dig that site because to dig up the tomb of Owen, the important warlord, mm-hmm. would be something incredible
right.
for them. The money to do these kind of digs is very scarce these days, and right. there's many other things that have to be dug up, and it's somewhere way down the list. But the fact is that they're not going to associate their name and say it's Arthur. They say, we don't know, Graham Phillips, it's his theory, but there's definitely something there. We've done the geophysics, so we would like to have an archaeological dig. The problem about digging this guy up to prove once and for all if there is something there that shows he is Arthur, for example, if he's buried with his sword as well, Arthur's sword is said in the earliest descriptions as having a golden hilt inscribed with two intertwined serpents. If that was found, it would go an awful long way to saying, wow, you know, this guy could be Arthur.
Right.
He's also said to have had an image of the Virgin Mary on his shield. Maybe some aspect of that could still survive. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it would be great to dig this, to have a proper archaeological dig and preserve what's there. The problem is that, I mean, at one point anyway, certainly the people who own the land, it's private. But the farmers were happy to have this, the farmers who owned the land were happy to have the geophysics scan done and would have been happy to have an archaeological dig take place at that time. The problem was that it's a protected monument because it's known to be like 1,500 years old or even older. Mm-hmm. It's got a preservation order on it, and you can't just go digging there without special permission from a government department.
Sure.
English Heritage, and they are, well, as all sort of bureaucracies, wheels turn very slowly.
Right.
I'm just trying to speed them up with their wheels because I've got the archaeologist behind me. Yeah, there's no problem about digging there unless, of course, the farmer decides to change his mind. But I think and I hope that what we actually do get is that English Heritage say, let's have a dig here, because if we don't, because now it's known about, anyone could start digging it up.
Someone's going to loot it. Right. Well, I sure hope that they become open to that. I mean, that would just be fascinating to see how that shakes out. So what's next for you then, Graham? I mean, you've written droves of books, all of which are incredibly fascinating and cover a wide range of different ancient mysteries. Do you have another book in the works that you can tell us about?
I'm writing a book at the moment, but I can't tell people what it's about because everybody just tries to jump on the bandwagon and copy me, and I end up with everybody else's books coming out before mine. But if I can tell you something about it, it's all about the mystery of Stonehenge and what it was really built for.
Very cool. And do you have an anticipated date when this thing's going to be published?
The 4th of July. I have no idea how to write it.
Sure.
So, I don't know. That's what I'm working on. I'm working on the possibility. That's not been taken on by a publisher yet.
Sure.
I'm working on an idea that's to do with Stonehenge.
Sure.
And the ancient stone circles of Britain and things like that, and ley lines, and if there is any actual truth behind those. Mm. Maybe not as energy lines, but as some kind of ancient trackways. But that's the general thing I'm working on. But I don't know for certain at the moment. I mean, really, it's been pretty quick. I only finished writing this book around Christmas. Then the publicity started. Mm-hmm. I'm exhausted.
Yeah, I get it. Well, very good. We look forward to staying in touch and keeping our listeners and readers up to speed with this new venture of yours. And you have a website too that people can follow your work on, correct?
Yeah, everything I'm doing pretty much on it. If I come up with any new ideas suddenly one week, my name is, website name, GrahamPhillips.net. Mm-hmm. GrahamPhillips.net. But if you just type Graham Phillips author into Google, you'll find me. But if you go onto the first page of my website, you'll find a link there to my Facebook, which I'm quite happy to have anybody join who's seriously interested in mysteries and stuff. Mm-hmm. And unless they say completely bonkers things, they can stay my Facebook friend.
Yeah, very cool. I love seeing authors and researchers do that. We had Laird Scranton on the show not too long ago, and he does the same thing. I mean, his Facebook, it's his personal Facebook, but it's open to his personal friends and people who want to follow his work, and he's very active. So I commend you for taking the same step. I think a lot of people that read books surrounding ancient mysteries, they like to have that connection with the author and the researcher. It makes it, feel more genuine, and that they're actually involved in that community. So that's incredible, Graham. I commend you on that. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. This conversation, we've done a lot of shows here for Lost Origins, and this one is absolutely one of my favorites. I mean, like I said, this is a story that I grew up with. And so to be able to pick your brain as to the historical backbone of this piece has just been incredible. So thank you so much, Graham. We do appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. I've been very much enjoyed myself.
Very good. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's episode of Lost Origins. Make sure that you hop over to innertraditions.com and pick up Graham's latest book, The Lost Tomb of King Arthur. You guys, we've been reading it here at Lost Origins in preparation for our review, which by the time you're listening to this, hop on over to our site. You can check out our review of the book. But it's fascinating. And if you're a fan of King Arthur or anything medieval, this is definitely for you. So we recommend you hop over to innertraditions.com and pick that book up today. You guys, make sure that you hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode or an article from your friends over here at Lost Origins. And make sure that you tune in next week. Next week, we've got a special treat for you. We're going to be bringing authors and researchers Janet Walter and Alan Butler on the show. This is the first time that we're bringing on multiple people at once. These two have done some incredible work together surrounding the ancient Masonic symbolism of Washington, D.C., and the secret goddess of the nation. So you don't want to miss that. Until next time, I'm your host, Andrew, and I want you all to continue to question everything.